All right, that brings us to the final unit and the first of the chapters in this final unit is about the digestive system. The digestive system obviously is named for digestion, but that's not its only function. Digestion actually is just one sub-function of one major function of the system. The major function of the system is the processing of food, of course, but that's not the only thing it does either. The digestive system is also important in protecting us. It has an immune function, and that makes sense because its structures form a boundary between the body and the outside, the rest of the universe, in other words. So it's a potential source of incoming pathogens. But the main function, of course, is the processing of food, and there are multiple aspects of that. Digestion is only one of those. We'll look at those specific things a little bit later. But let's look at the basic anatomy of the organ system. The overall digestive system you can think of as really containing two major parts, one of which is the alimentary canal. Now, the alimentary canal is also called the digestive tract. It's a continuous tube from the mouth to the anus. It takes twists and turns here and there, but it's a continuous tube. It has a beginning and an end in terms of the flow of materials through that alimentary canal. And the word aliment, by the way, means nourishment. So alimentary means of nourishment or of food. And that's why the alimentary canal gets its name. As I've said several times when we were meeting face to face, the alimentary canal, or the interior of the alimentary canal, is actually outside of the body. So we don't put food into our bodies. We put food into a tube that our body surrounds. The alimentary canal, though, consists of many parts, of course, but it's one major, it's the bulk of the anatomy of the digestive system. There are some organs, though, that are not actually part of the alimentary canal, but are part of the digestive system, and they, in a sense, are accessory organs because they are not part of that alimentary canal. In other words, food does not pass through them, but they are connected to the alimentary canal. And by far the biggest and most important of those is the liver that we see here in the opening slide. Associated with the liver is the gallbladder. The gallbladder is a storage device, really, for something that the liver produces, which is bile. Bile is important in digestion, as I'll mention a little bit later. But that's why the gallbladder is associated with the liver. The bile that the liver makes gets put into the gallbladder for storage, and then later on, when it's needed, the gallbladder can squeeze and release that bile into the alimentary canal, into the small intestine specifically. The pancreas is also an accessory organ because it's not actually part of the alimentary canal. It connects to the alimentary canal. And just like the liver and gallbladder deliver things to the alimentary canal, so does the pancreas. The pancreas secretes pancreatic juice, which is something we'll talk about a little bit later that helps in digestion. But that's why it needs to connect. That's why the pancreas needs to connect to the alimentary canal so that the digestive juices that it produces get delivered into the lumen of the alimentary canal. And also there are salivary glands that are accessory organs because they are not part of the alimentary canal but connect to it. The salivary glands are named for the fact that they produce saliva, which is a mostly watery, but it's a solution. It's not just water, of course. Saliva contains many things, including some digestive enzymes. It also contains some things that can kill bacteria as they come into the mouth and therefore could be a threat to you. The salivary glands come in three types, as you see here. Parotid is a word that means next to the ear, and you can see that's its placement. Otid means of the ear, and para means next to, so parotid means next to the ear. Sublingual means under the tongue. Lingual means of the tongue, so sublingual is underneath the tongue, as you can see it's placed. And submandibular are, the submandibular salivary glands are located inferior to the mandible, which is the lower jawbone. Now, the alimentary canal itself, you can think of as a sequence of structures. I say sequence because there's a certain order to it in terms of how materials pass through it. So the mouth or the oral cavity, which includes the tongue, is the first part of the alimentary canal. That leads then to the throat, which is called the pharynx. And the pharynx is more than just about a passageway for food and drink. The pharynx, or throat, is kind of like a hallway, because it's a common passageway for air and food and drink. Now, the air, of course, goes one place different from the food and water. The food and drink go through the pharynx into the esophagus so that they can be delivered to the stomach, whereas the air goes through the pharynx and then exits the pharynx through a different opening to go into the trachea, not shown here, which is part of the respiratory system. But the pharynx is the throat, and one of the exits from the pharynx is the esophagus. Esophagus has the same word in it, word root, phag, as in phagocytosis, meaning cell eating, remember? So the esophagus is the eating tube. It transports food and drink from the pharynx into the stomach, which is the next part of the alimentary canal. The stomach is mostly a storage device. A lot of people probably think differently. If you just randomly ask people, probably a lot of people think the stomach does a lot of digestion. It doesn't really do all that much, at least doesn't do very much chemical digestion. It's mostly a storage device, and it releases the contents a little bit at a time into the next part of the alimentary canal, which is the small intestine. Now, the small intestine is very long and windy, but there are three parts to it. These are all part of the small intestine. Duodenum is first. That gets us a name that means two and ten, duo, two and den, ten, meaning 12 overall. It got its name because the length of it is about 12 widths of a human finger. Someone measured it that way. That's how it got its name. The duodenum then gives rise to the jejunum, and then finally the jejunum gives rise to the ileum. That's the order of the three parts of the small intestine. It's harder to see where the jejunum and ileum, where the jejunum ends and the ileum begins, but it's somewhere in there. You don't have to know where that happens. Just those are the three parts of the small intestine. And the small intestine is where by far most of the digestion takes place, and also where by far most of the absorption takes place. Those are functions we'll be talking about in a little bit. The small intestine then empties into the large intestine right around here. And the large intestine itself has several parts, as you can see. The first of which is the cecum. The cecum receives materials from the small intestine, in other words, specifically from the ileum of the small intestine. And that's why the division between those two is called the ileocecal valve. But the cecum is the first part of the large intestine. In most people, it's right here in the left lower quadrant of the abdomen. I'm sorry, the right lower quadrant. Now, thinking in terms of the flow of food, food is going to move superiorly because that's the way the large intestine is arranged. So the cecum then gives rise to the ascending colon because movement is upward. That's what ascending means. And then it takes a right, more or less right angle curve to become the transverse colon, so-called, because it's moving in a transverse direction with respect to the long axis of the body. And that gets it from right to left. And then at the left side of the abdomen, just below the spleen, as you see here, or just inferior to the spleen, it takes another right-hand curve to become the descending colon. And then at the end of the descending colon, it takes kind of an S-shaped curve. And that's why this part of the large intestine is called the sigmoid colon. Sigmoid means S-shaped, or shaped like a sigma, really, which is a Greek S. At the end of the sigmoid colon, it straightens out, notice. The colon, or large intestine, straightens out. And that's why this next part is called the rectum. Rect means straight, just like in rectangle, something with straight angles. The rectum is straight, and just like the word rectus femoris, for instance, or rectus femoris, that's the rectum. And then finally you have the anal canal, which ends in a ring called the anus. That's the very last part of not only the large intestine, but it's also the last part of the overall alimentary canal. So that's why I say that the alimentary canal is a continuous tube running from mouth to anus, including all those parts I just mentioned. If we look at the next slide, slide 2, we can concentrate on the oral cavity and the pharynx. Now, the oral cavity, oral simply means of the mouth. So in the oral cavity, you have, or parts associated with the oral cavity, are the tongue, which is mostly muscle. And the tongue is important not only for eating, but for speech as well. You also have teeth, which are important digestive structures because they perform mechanical digestion. They help out in mechanical digestion. The digestion, as a word by itself, refers to the breakdown of materials. And so what we put into the oral cavity is food. We call it food still. It doesn't continue to be called food, though, as it makes its way farther down the alimentary canal. But it's food while it's in the mouth. And the mouth, which is the first part of the alimentary canal, is also where digestion starts. But there are two types of digestion, one of which is mechanical digestion. That refers to physically breaking big chunks into smaller chunks, and that's why the teeth are so important for that. The teeth not only allow you to rip a chunk of food from a bigger thing so that you can put that smaller thing into your mouth, but then once in the mouth, mastication, which is the name for chewing, breaks that piece of food that you put into your mouth into smaller and smaller chunks as you continue to masticate or chew. So that's mechanical digestion. Chemical digestion is the other type of digestion, and that refers to breaking, at a molecular level, larger molecules that are in the food into smaller molecules, and that requires the help of enzymes. And some enzymes are delivered to the food right away in the oral cavity, specifically enzymes that are components of saliva. So the salivary glands secrete saliva more or less continuously to keep your mouth moist, but when you eat, they secrete a lot more saliva, delivering enzymes to the mouth. But not all foods start chemically being digested in the mouth. Most don't. Starch, on the other hand, can start being chemically digested while it's still in the mouth because there is an enzyme called salivary amylase that the saliva contains, and it breaks starch, which is a polysaccharide, into smaller saccharides, simpler sugars, in other words. Now, as mastication occurs, and mastication not only helps by mechanically digesting, but it also mixes saliva with the food. And saliva contains not only digestive enzymes. It also contains mucus. That mucus mixes with the food and creates what is called a bolus, B-O-L-U-S, a food bolus, a little ball of food, basically, which is food and saliva and mucus. That all gets delivered to the back of the mouth when you're ready to swallow. And the just like mastication is the fancy word for chewing, the fancy word for swallowing is deglutition, D-E-G-L-U-T-I-T-I-O-N. And so that's the end of, at least for that bite, that is the end of the contribution by the oral cavity. Deglutition, or swallowing, then delivers that food bolus into the pharynx. And the pharynx has different parts to it. The oropharynx is the region of the pharynx that is next to or connected to the oral cavity. Oral meaning oral, of the mouth. Oropharynx first, and then you have the laryngopharynx, which is named for the fact that it's the part of the pharynx or the part of the throat that is next to the larynx. Now, the larynx is the anatomical name for what we call the voice box, which is part of the respiratory system, really, but it's part of the alimentary canal as well, but the laryngopharynx is this region of the throat. And notice that the larynx is part of the respiratory system. It's the very top of the part that is airway only, whereas the laryngopharynx is the part of the throat near that airway. So air goes into the trachea, but food and drink travel through the laryngopharynx to the esophagus. And the esophagus is only for food and drink. Now, obviously, food or drink could get into the trachea, but you don't ever want that to happen. And during deglutition or swallowing, this fold of cartilage called the epiglottis gets forced downward, kind of like closing a toilet seat. And that seals off the airway so that the food and drink will not go into the trachea. And if any does, you will quickly start coughing to get that out of there. Only air should go in there, but under normal circumstances, none does, because this epiglottis closes it off and the food and drink slide instead into the esophagus rather than the trachea. Now, there are also tonsils associated with the mouth, but the tonsils really are not part of the digestive system. They are part of the lymphatic system because they protect you from invading microorganisms. The nasopharynx, by the way, I didn't mention, also part of the pharynx, but it's named obviously for the fact that it is the part that's connected to the nasal cavity. So air comes in through the nose, goes through the nasopharynx, oropharynx, and laryngopharynx, but then goes into the trachea, whereas food skips the nasopharynx, unless you snort your food, which you shouldn't do. Food goes through the oral cavity, skips the nasopharynx, goes through the oropharynx and laryngopharynx to enter the esophagus. By the way, the little grape-like structure that hangs down in the back of your throat is called the uvula, which is a word that means grape. Let's go to three now and look at the front view with the tongue stuck out. You can see the opening to the pharynx, which is the oropharynx, is the opening between the oral cavity and the pharynx, and you can see the uvula hanging down. But you also get a good view of the roof of the mouth, or the palate, as it's called. But there are two parts of the palate: the hard palate, which is bony material underneath the epithelium that lines it, and therefore has a hardness to it, and the soft palate, which is there is no bone under or deep to this epithelium, so it's much softer and pliable as the food bolus deforms it during deglutition. You can also get a good view of the teeth, and the teeth are surrounded by, or at least the bases of the teeth are surrounded by the gingiva, which means gum. The plural is gingivae, as you see here, but usually we just say gingiva, meaning a gum, the pinkish material around where a tooth is embedded. Slide 4. Is this the same as 2? I shouldn't have included this. Sorry about that. Let's go on to slide 5. Now, what we see in slide 5 is actually a section of small intestine, but it could have been actually taken from anywhere along the alimentary canal. As far as what the important thing being conveyed here is, the important information is that anywhere along the alimentary canal, you have an arrangement of tissues concentrically, meaning circles like on a archery target, one circle surrounded by another circle and so on. If you look at it in cross-section, which this is, then there are concentric regions. And you can see that these, with the bold print, that these concentric layers get different names. So let's work from the part that is in direct contact with the material. I say material because, as I said earlier, we don't keep calling it food. It's food when it's in the mouth, and then once it's swallowed and starting in the stomach, we call it chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. And then once we get it into the large intestines, it's no longer chyme, then it's called feces. But it's material in of one type or another all the way through the alimentary canal. And so let's talk about these layers of the alimentary canal, starting from the part that is in direct contact with that material, as you see right here. And that part is called the mucosa. It's called the mucosa because it is a mucous membrane. Mucus meaning, remember there's two spellings of mucus. M-U-C-O-U-S is an adjective. M-U-C-U-S is the noun. Mucus, M-U-C-U-S, is the stuff, the sticky, thick fluid. And a mucous membrane, M-U-C-O-U-S, is a membrane that produces mucus. Well, a mucosa, the mucosa is called that because it is a mucous membrane. It produces mucus. And this includes everywhere along the alimentary canal, starting right from the mouth. I've talked about mucus in the mouth that gets mixed with the food as you start eating and start masticating. Well, that mucus is good lubricant. So it's important, obviously, for this material, food, then chyme, then feces, to pass through the alimentary canal. And that's a major function of the mucus produced by the mucosa. It lubricates the material and allows it to slip through much more easily. Notice that the mucosa, which is this whole layer right here, includes a thin muscle layer. Muscle, by the way, surrounding the muscle associated with the alimentary canal or the digestive system is smooth muscle, of course. Remember that the muscular system includes only skeletal muscle. There's three types of muscle tissue. Smooth muscle and cardiac muscle are not part of the muscular system. Smooth muscle is found in several systems, including the digestive system, and this is a thin layer. That's part of the mucosa. Now, wrapped around the outside of that is the next layer, which is called submucosa, meaning under the mucosa, so it's the next layer. And notice that the submucosa is connective tissue mostly, with a rich supply of arteries, veins, and lymphatic vessels. In other words, blood vessels and lymphatic vessels. And this makes sense. Makes sense that there's a lot of vessels associated with the alimentary canal. because this is how the alimentary canal is where materials that are in the food that you eat finally enter the body. Remember, the food is not in your body. Your body is wrapped around that food. Well, eventually, after digestion into small enough pieces at the molecular level, those molecules can actually pass from outside of the body, which is in the lumen of the alimentary canal, into the cells of the body. And when they do that, they then need to enter the blood and the lymph in order to be distributed to the rest of the body. So that's the submucosa. And then the next, wrapped around the submucosa, the next layer is the muscularis, or muscularis externa. Muscularis is obviously named for the fact that it is mostly muscular. You can see layers of smooth muscle here. And no matter where you cut a cross-section of the alimentary canal, there are going to be at least two layers of muscle in the muscularis, longitudinal muscle and circular muscle. Now, they're named that for the grain of the muscle. Longitudinal muscle layer has long grain along the long axis of the alimentary canal. And remember, muscles only shorten, so when the longitudinal muscle layer contracts, that would be like bunching up, if you imagine a poster, brand new poster, when you first buy it, is wrapped in plastic. The plastic is like the longitudinal muscle, and if you bunch that up in trying to get the poster out, that's what would happen when the longitudinal muscle contracts. It gets shorter along the long axis, whereas the circular muscle layer has circular grain to it, and when it contracts, it makes the diameter of this circle smaller. It squeezes down on the circle. That's the muscularis, or muscularis externa. And then the outermost layer is called either serosa, as you see here, or adventitia, adventitia. And that depends on where you are. As I said, this example is shown at the small intestine, and the outer layer there is called serosa. Serosa, it gets its name because it is a serous membrane. We've talked about serous membranes before, and remember, any serous membrane contains two layers, a visceral layer and a parietal layer, and between those two layers is serous fluid. Well, a lot of the alimentary canal is actually surrounded by a serous membrane called the peritoneum. And so the serosa layer is really just the visceral layer of that peritoneum. But the peritoneum does not actually surround every part of the alimentary canal. For instance, the mouth and the esophagus, they're not surrounded by that peritoneum, which is in the abdomen. Instead, the outer layer on that is a connective tissue layer. It's not a serous membrane, but it's a connective tissue layer called adventitia. But anyway, there's four different layers no matter where you cut it. By the way, notice that there are these yellow things. These are nerves. We talked about the nervous system already, but the digestive system has a very, very huge number of neurons associated with it, arranged in nerves that are called enteric nerves. Now, enteric, a word by itself, just means of the gut or of the alimentary canal. Another word for gut or alimentary canal is enteron, and therefore enteric means of the gut. And myo, remember, means muscle, so the muscle of the gut. Myenteric nerve plexus, it refers to a network of nerves that control these muscles. So the smooth muscles get signals from the myenteric nerve plexuses, allowing for even greater movement or a lesser movement. In slide 6, we get a much better view in this mid-sagittal section of the peritoneum. I was talking about earlier. The peritoneum is a serous membrane in the abdomen. So there's a visceral and a parietal layer, but it is unlike the more simple serous membranes that we already talked about, the two pleurae, one for each lung, and the pericardium around the heart. The peritoneum is much more complex in terms of its shape. It folds here and there, and all of this is part of the peritoneum. And in fact, parts of the peritoneum even have different names. For instance, the part of the peritoneum that goes from the liver to the stomach, as you see here, is called the lesser omentum. There are two omenta. The lesser omentum is the smaller one, that's why it's called lesser. And then there's also part of that same overall peritoneum, but the part that hangs down from the stomach and then hangs down in front of the small intestines and then comes back up and joins to the transverse colon, that's called the greater omentum. You can see the greater omentum right here in the photograph on the left. It hangs down from the stomach and then wraps around, and you don't see this part of it where it connects to the large intestine because it's obscured by this front part. But this greater omentum is where a lot of fat can accumulate depending on how many calories are taken in. When extra calories are taken in, that more than you need, those calories are stored as, or that energy is stored as fat, which can accumulate in the greater omentum, which is why the greater omentum is sometimes called the fatty apron, because it hangs down like an apron and contains a lot of fat. I guess that's all I want to talk about on that one. Let's go on to 7 and look at the stomach. Now, a little bit earlier when we were talking about the layers of the alimentary canal, I said that no matter where you cut, you're going to have at least 2 layers in the muscularis externa, and that's true for the stomach as well. But in the stomach, you also have a 3rd layer. So there's the longitudinal layer, there's the circular layer, just as in all other places of the alimentary canal. But there's also a 3rd layer called the oblique layer, because its grain is diagonal with respect to the other two. And the reason that there is an extra layer of muscle in the stomach is that this allows the stomach to churn. So there's much more movement in the stomach than there are in other places in the alimentary canal. Now, I said also earlier that the stomach doesn't really do all that much digestion. Specifically, it doesn't really do all that much chemical digestion. But it does help out in mechanical digestion quite a bit because of this churning. And because there's these 3 layers of muscle in the muscularis externa, the churning allows the stomach basically to squeeze on the contents of the stomach, which is the chyme. Remember, by the time it gets to the stomach, we call it chyme, no longer food. The overall shape of the stomach is such that it's broken into different regions. Fundus is a word that means a blind end of something that is opposite to an open end. For instance, if you think of an urn, the opening of the urn is at one end, and then the blind end, which is where you set it, of that is the fundus of the urn. Well, that's why this was called this for the stomach. This is not an end that has an opening. The opening is at the other end. So this is the fundic region, or the fundus of the stomach. The main region is the body, and then at the other end, opposite of the fundus, where there is an opening, is the pyloric region. Now, really, there are 2 openings to the stomach, obviously, but notice that the fundus is not where that entry into the stomach is located. It's located a little bit to the side of the fundus. So, food enters from the esophagus right here on the stomach, and this is the cardiac region of the stomach. Now, cardiac means of the heart, obviously. And that's why it's called that. It lies fairly close to the heart. That's where food enters. So that's an entryway only, unless you're puking. But under normal circumstances, that's entry only. The exit from the stomach into the small intestine is where the pyloric region is. And pylorus, which is the noun that pyloric is the adjective form of, pylorus means gatekeeper. And that's a good description of the pyloric sphincter, which is a ring of muscle here, because the pylorus or gatekeeper opens up now and then to allow a little bit, not all, a little bit of the contents of the stomach into the small intestine. And that's why I called the stomach largely a storage device earlier, because the small intestine needs to get just little batches of chyme for it to be efficient in digesting that chyme into smaller and smaller molecules. So the stomach not only churns with its muscles to move things back and forth within the stomach, and that's part of mechanical digestion, but it also, because of muscular contraction, can now and then squeeze a little bit of that chyme through the pylorus, or the gatekeeper, into the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine. When you're looking at the interior lining of the stomach, notice this rough or ridged appearance. These folds are called rugae. That's the plural of ruga. If you don't have the E, it's ruga. But there are many rugae on the surface of the interior of the stomach. And these folds allow for the stomach to become much bigger, which makes these rugae unfold when you fill it with food. So an empty stomach has rugae that are very folded, and then if you eat a lot, those rugae become less and less folded and more smooth, allowing the stomach to get pretty big. Now there's also a lesser curvature, as you see here, and a greater curvature associated with the stomach. So the stomach has an overall curved shape as it makes its way from the esophagus to the small intestine. Oh, by the way, sphincter. We've already talked about sphincters in circulatory system. There were sphincters, which were rings of muscles controlling the diameter of the blood vessels, as we talked about, in capillary beds. Well, there are other sphincters in the body as well. And so there's a sphincter up here at the entryway, even though you can't see it here because it hasn't cut away in this part of the view. That sphincter is called the cardiac sphincter because it's the ring of muscle that has to open up to allow for food to enter the stomach. And then it closes back down after the food enters the stomach, so it doesn't go back up into the esophagus. If you've heard of acid reflux, that's when acid, which should stay in the stomach, makes its way through that cardiac sphincter back up into the esophagus. That's what causes heartburn and worse problems. But normally, the sphincter will only open up when food is being swallowed into the stomach, and then it will close back up. The pyloric sphincter is another ring of muscle that opens up only when the stomach squirts a little bit of the chyme into the duodenum. Then it closes again and will open again later, as need be. All right, now we can go to 8. This is just a photograph of the stomach, and so there's no new information in terms of anatomy here, other than the word antrum. The antrum is just a word that means cave or cavern, so it's an empty space. Well, the whole interior of the stomach, of course, is an empty space, but this region is called antrum because it's like a narrowing compared to the rest of it, so more like a cave. The antrum gives rise to the pyloric region. But looking at it as a photograph rather than a cartoon, you see a good view of the rugae, or the folds in the stomach that allow it to stretch quite a bit. It's really not stretching so much as just unfolding. Okay, now back to cartoons in slide 9. And here we are looking at a very close-up view of just a little bit of the lining of the stomach. And the mucosa, which is the layer that is in direct contact with the chyme, as you see, is made up of many cells. Each one of these little things is one cell, so this is really close-up view. Well, there are gastric pits in the lining of the stomach, and each pit is like a blind-ended tunnel. And so you can see the opening of these two gastric pits. These ones would have similar linings by cells, as you see here. And this gives you a view of the fact that there are different kinds of cells making up this epithelium. There are mucous neck cells. They're called neck cells because they're close to the neck or narrow region of these gastric pits. And they're called mucus because they produce mucus. So that's their major function. There are also parietal cells and chief cells. And we'll look in the next slide at what these do. These are not mucus cells. They produce different things. Let's take a look at that in slide 10. The parietal cells get their name for the same reason that the parietal bones of the skull do. Parietal means like a wall. And so they are part of this wall of a gastric pit. That's how they got their name. But the parietal cells produce something that is classified as a proenzyme. Pro means before. So a proenzyme is not an active enzyme. It's a molecule that can be converted into an enzyme. But while it's a proenzyme, it's not doing its job as an enzyme yet. It needs to be converted into the active form to become an enzyme. And the specific proenzyme that parietal cells make in the lining of the stomach is called pepsinogen. The gen part means creation, like in Genesis. And so pepsinogen gets its name because it can create or be converted into pepsin, which is the actual active form of the enzyme. Parietal cells don't make pepsin. Parietal cells, chief cells, not parietal cells, make pepsinogen. And chief cells do not make the active enzyme pepsin. They make pepsinogen. Parietal cells make something entirely different. They make hydrochloric acid, which is what HCl stands for. And what you see here with this arrow going from pepsinogen to pepsin is a chemical reaction. Pepsinogen gets converted into pepsin, a totally different chemical. That's the active form of the enzyme. But that will only happen chemically if the acidity is high. In other words, if the pH is low. And that's why hydrochloric acid helps this out. So, chief cells produce the pepsinogen, which is the proenzyme. Parietal cells produce hydrochloric acid, and that in the presence of hydrochloric acid, the pepsinogen gets converted into pepsin, which is the active form of the enzyme. Now, pepsin gets its name because it's an enzyme that chemically digests proteins. And the reason the name makes sense is that proteins are made up of amino acids that are bonded together, and those bonds are called peptide bonds. So pepsin gets named for the fact that it breaks peptide bonds. Now, I said earlier that not all that much chemical digestion occurs in the stomach, but some does, and proteins start to be broken down in the stomach. They can't be broken down in the mouth because saliva does not contain protein-degrading enzymes. It has to start in the stomach. But proteins are really important structures in all cells, as we've talked about. So you wouldn't want pepsin, which is an enzyme that breaks proteins into amino acids, or breaks them into smaller chunks of amino acids, you wouldn't want that enzyme to be in your cells, right? Because that would be a dangerous thing to have. It would be destroying the proteins that are in your cells. And that's why chief cells don't make pepsin. They make pepsinogen, which is safe to have around, and then they secrete it out of the cells and really out of the body into the lumen of the stomach. Remember, the stomach is part of the alimentary canal, and it's really outside of your body. Once it's safely out of the cells, then with the help of the acid, the hydrochloric acid produced by parietal cells, that pepsinogen from chief cells gets converted into the pepsin. And there is where it can do its job. The protein that's in the stomach is the stuff you do want to break down. And so pepsin starts that protein digestion, but as we'll see, most of the protein digestion occurs after the stomach in the small intestine. One type of cell I didn't mention earlier are these green ones, which are called enteroendocrine cells. Entero, once again, means of the gut. Endocrine, of course, means involving hormones. And so that's true. Enteroendocrine cells produce signal molecules that I'm really not going to get too deeply into, but that's their function. Those signals actually determine how much secretion is done by these other types of cells. Now we can go on to slide 11, take a closer look at the liver and pancreas. So the stomach has been removed right here, but it would be in this region, and the stomach, of course, empties into the small intestine. That would be the pyloric sphincter right here, where the pyloric sphincter is the official boundary between the stomach, not shown here, and the beginning of the small intestine, which is the duodenum. And the duodenum, if you ever do a dissection, is always found as a hairpin loop. And in that hairpin loop is where you'll find the pancreas. Whether it's a human you're dissecting or some other sort of animal, you'll find the pancreas in this hairpin loop of the duodenum. That's why you can see it that in that position in the rat dissection. Now, the liver is not only the largest organ of the digestive system, it's also the largest gland in the body. It does many different things, not all of which have to do with digestion. It does a lot of important things, though. It is a member of the digestive system, though. And as a gland, it, of course, secretes something. And the major secretion of the liver is a fluid called bile. So bile is produced by the cells that make up the liver, which are called hepatocytes. Hepato means of the liver. And then as that bile gets secreted by the cells in the liver, it gets delivered, the bile does, into tubes, vessels that carry that bile away from the liver, and some of it ends up in this green bag that we see here called the gallbladder. Now, the gallbladder not only stores this bile, but while that bile is in the gallbladder, it actually gets concentrated because water gets removed from it. So gallbladder is a bile storage device, but it also concentrates the bile. The bile itself is very complex mixture. There's many things in it. But as far as digestion is concerned, an important component of bile is a lipid that acts as a detergent. Detergents are things that emulsify. To emulsify means to break into smaller and smaller droplets. And so this is what happens when we use soap, for instance, on our hands. If we have oil on our hands, it doesn't do to just rinse them with water, and that's because oil and water don't mix. But if you use a detergent, which soaps contain, that detergent will surround droplets of oil, or oil is a lipid, and that will break a big droplet into smaller and smaller droplets, each of which is surrounded by little detergent molecules. And when they're emulsified or broken into small enough droplets, then they can be rinsed off of your hands in that example. Well, the same thing is happening when you have lipids in the diet. And that's why bile contains detergent, which gets delivered into the lumen of the small intestine. So the bile which originates in the liver but can be stored in the gallbladder, eventually makes its way through bile ducts into the duodenum. But notice that this bile duct passes through the pancreas before it actually gets delivered into this duodenum of the small intestine. The pancreas, meanwhile, is also a gland. And the pancreas is really multiple glands in one. It is both an endocrine gland and an exocrine gland. Endocrine glands, of course, are ductless. They do not have ducts, and they produce signal molecules that get released into the bloodstream. Exocrine glands, on the other hand, do have ducts, and the secretory product, the thing that's secreted, get delivered into those ducts. Well, the endocrine function of the pancreas is not about digestion. We studied the endocrine function of the pancreas in the endocrine system chapter. And the major endocrine secretions of the pancreas are glucagon and insulin. The exocrine secretions of the pancreas are directly related to the digestive system. They are the digestive function of the pancreas. And that juice, called pancreatic juice, the exocrine secretion of the pancreas, collects in this pancreatic duct. And notice that the pancreatic duct combines with the bile duct into one major tube that empties into the duodenum. And the place where this happens is called the hepatopancreatic ampulla. Another word for ampulla is a little vial. It looks like a little vial. But it's called hepatopancreatic because it involves the liver and the pancreas. And it is guarded by its own sphincter, so there's a ring of muscle that can clamp down on this so that nothing goes into the small intestine until it gets a signal. When it gets the signal, then the sphincter will relax. That will open it up and allow either bile from the liver and gallbladder or pancreatic juice from the pancreas or both to enter the duodenum and get mixed with the chyme that is being passed through that small intestine. The pancreatic juice, by the way, is a mixture of bicarbonate ion, which is able to neutralize the acidity of the chyme, and also pancreatic enzymes that digest at a molecular level larger molecules into smaller molecules. And so they are both components of pancreatic juice. Now, the hydrochloric acid that gets mixed from the stomach into the chyme makes the pH very low there. The enzymes that have to operate for digestion in the small intestine can't operate well at that low pH or high acidity. Therefore, the chyme gets neutralized by the bicarbonate ion component of the pancreatic juice. This brings the pH back up to normal so that the enzymes that are taking over the job of digestion in the small intestine can work well. Okay, let's go to the slide 12 and look at a cutaway view of the small intestine. The small intestine is where not only most of the digestion takes place, it's also where by far most of the absorption takes place. Digestion refers to breaking things down, and that includes, as I said, mechanical digestion and chemical digestion. Well, the type of digestion happening in the small intestine is almost entirely chemical digestion. And absorption refers to when those now small enough particles, because they've been digested, when they finally enter the body, because the lumen, remember, is outside of the body. They enter the body via absorption. That's when they pass into the cells lining the small intestine mostly. Now, there's a little bit of absorption that can take place in the mouth and the stomach and the esophagus, but it's almost none compared to the absorption that takes place in the small intestine. And so that's why we have in the lining of the small intestine folds that are called plici circularis, or just that's just a another language that means circular folds. So they are major folds that occur like little circles along the length of the small intestine. And why have these folds? Well, the more folds you have, the more surface area you have. If this were just a smooth surface like the inside of a garden hose, then there wouldn't be nearly as much surface area. I just got done telling you that a major job of the small intestine is absorption. Well, the more surface area you have, the more absorption can take place, because the surface is where that absorption takes place. And therefore, having folds back and forth rather than just smoothness drastically increases the surface area. But this is just one level of the increase in surface area. This is the macroscopic or large level increase in surface area. The circular folds are then, each individual circular fold is then folded itself, as you see here, in what are called villi. That's the plural of villus. A villus is a finger-like projection. And so one fold, which already increases the surface area, is then itself folded into villi. And so that increases the surface area much more again. And then if we look at slide 13, each individual villus, which is lined by individual cells that we see here, actually we don't see the detail in 13, but we see the cells lining each villus. Each villus has a cell lining it, and when we look in the next slide at an individual cell, it actually has folds in it, in the membrane of that cell, which makes it even much more surface area. All of that drastically increases the surface area. Before we look at that, though, let's look at what's inside one of these villi. You have epithelium lining the actual villus, but in the depth of the villus, you have vessels. Blood vessels and lymphatic vessels. The blood vessels are shown blue and red. The green one is a lymphatic vessel. We've talked about lymphatic vessels in the lymphatic system already, and most of those lymphatic vessels are collecting lymph, which is leaked from blood vessels. Well, these are specialized lymphatic vessels associated just with the small intestine, and they occur within each villus. They are called lacteals, and I think I mentioned it before that lact means milk, like lactation is the production of milk. Lacteals get named for the fact that the stuff that they absorb from originally the food that's coming in here is rich in lipid, and that makes it look whitish or milky appearance. It has nothing to do with milk, but that's why they were called lacteals. So the materials that get absorbed from the chyme that's flowing through the small intestine get put into two different places. There are three major categories of nutrients. There are proteins, there are polysaccharides, and there are fats. Well, the proteins get broken down eventually into amino acids, and those amino acids get absorbed into the bloodstream, directly into blood vessels, in other words. The polysaccharides, which are large complex sugars, get broken down into monosaccharides eventually, and that makes them small enough to be absorbed. Well, they also get absorbed into and put directly into the bloodstream in blood vessels. The fats, on the other hand, are broken down or digested into glycerol and fatty acids. The glycerol gets put into the bloodstream, into blood vessels. But the fatty acids, the other parts of the fats, do not go into the bloodstream directly. They get put into lacteals, and that's what makes them look. That's what makes the contents of these look milky. They have a lot of fatty acids. Now, recall though that the lymphatic vessels, not only the lacteals but all the other lymphatic vessels, eventually will dump the contents into the bloodstream, but that's not going to happen until it gets back to the subclavian veins, where the lymphatic fluid gets put into the bloodstream. So these fatty acids don't go directly to the liver like the other nutrients that go into the bloodstream directly do. Instead, the fatty acids in the lacteals go via the lymph eventually to the bloodstream at the subclavian veins, and finally eventually make it to the liver and other parts of the body, but they take a roundabout way. Now finally, in slide 14, we can see that each of those individual cells on a villus has a folded plasma membrane, just like the villi we were looking at, but these are microscopic versions, just many within one cell, so they're called microvilli. So there's three levels of increase in surface area: the plici circularis, or circular folds, each of which has villi, which is another increase in surface area, and then the cells of each villus has microvilli. And therefore, when you add all that up, there is a tremendous amount of surface area, and that's why by the time that material, that chyme that's flowing through the lumen of the small intestine, by the time it gets through the small intestine, all that surface area gives the small intestine a chance to absorb all of the nutrients from that into the body. That brings us then to the large intestine, which doesn't do all that much absorption. Well, it doesn't absorb nutrients. The nutrients get absorbed at the small intestine. So what's left over, the stuff that is still outside of the body and has not been absorbed, in other words, the residue, which is a word that means stuff that's left over, that's what gets delivered from the small intestine. And we see the very end of the small intestine here. Remember, the ileum is the last part of the small intestine. That's what gets delivered into the first part of the large intestine. It's just the residue. There isn't much nutritional value to it because the nutrients have already been absorbed. And this, which was being called chyme up until this point, is when we start calling it feces. Feces is just mostly bacteria, but also stuff that has not been able to be absorbed, like roughage. That gets delivered into the first part of the large intestine, and it's pretty moist. The feces that start out in the cecum, first part of the large intestine, is wet feces. It then gets dried out. So when I said there's not much absorption that takes place in the large intestine, it's not much absorption of nutrients, but the large intestine does absorb water, and therefore as the feces travel through the large intestine, the feces get more and more dried out and become more and more able to be formed into pellets. So it travels from the small intestine into the cecum, then into the ascending colon, then it makes the turn into the transverse colon, then another turn into the descending colon, then into the sigmoid colon, then into the rectum, the straight part, into the anal canal, and then out of the body. Well, out of the alimentary canal. It's the whole time it's really outside of the body. One thing I haven't mentioned is this little piece that hangs off of the cecum. That is the appendix. But often it's called the vermiform appendix, V-E-R-M-I-F-O-R-M. Vermis means worm, so vermiform means shaped like a worm. That's self-explanatory. It's shaped like a little worm. And we used to yank these out pretty routinely surgically because for a long time we thought they were useless. Vestigial is the word we use, meaning no longer performing a function and on its way out evolutionarily. But we've rethought this in recent decades. And there's a lot of evidence that says that the appendix could be a place that houses bacteria that are beneficial, and that can, now those beneficial bacteria are all throughout the large intestine, but sometimes in case of severe diarrhea or cholera or other disorders, those good bacteria can be flushed out of the large intestine. But the since the appendix is like a little cave separated from the flow of things, these good bacteria can hide, a fraction of these good bacteria can survive in the appendix even when the rest of the good bacteria get flushed from the large intestine. And therefore, this can be a reservoir of good bacteria that can then repopulate the overall large intestine after these depletions. Notice also that there's a lot of so-called Peyer's patches, P-E-Y-E-R. That's what these little yellow things are. Those are made of lymphatic tissue, so they are important in protecting you from invaders. Haustrum is the word for, it really means pouch, but these pouch-like segments that the large intestine has along its surface, those are called haustra. That's the plural of haustrum. 16 is a view of a tooth, just a single tooth to look at the parts of it. A tooth is made of different materials. The superficial layer, the part that we actually see and the part that food scrapes against as we chew, is enamel. And enamel is the hardest material in the body. It is made very similar to the stuff that makes up bone, but it's much harder than bone even, which makes sense because it has to undergo a lot of abrasive force when you chew food. Deep to that is dentin, which is also similar to bone, but it's not as hard as enamel, and that makes up the thickest of the hard layers. And then deep to that is pulp. Pulp is loose connective tissue that surrounds vessels and nerves. And you also have a material called cementum, or just cement it's called here, that is a layer that allows for adhesion of the tooth's root to the periodontal ligament. Periodontal, by the way, means around a tooth. Odont means tooth. Peri means around. So periodontal means around a tooth. And it's a ligament that holds this thing in place. Normally we think of ligaments as connecting a bone to another bone. In the case of a periodontal ligament, it connects a tooth to a bone. So this is bone of the jaw. It could be either the axilla, upper jaw, or the mandible, lower jaw. The hollow tooth socket, if the tooth's not there, is called an alveolus, which means little sac. That's why we use the same word to describe the little sacs that make up the lung. But each dental alveolus or tooth socket is filled by a tooth. Okay, now let's go on and talk about chemical digestion in greater detail. In slide 17, we're looking at digestion of carbohydrates. Now, carbohydrates, remember, can be big or small. The name that we give to large carbohydrates is polysaccharides. Starch is an example of a polysaccharide. It's the main polysaccharide that we get from food, like a banana, for instance, is full of starch. Starch is really made of nothing but glucose, but it's a lot of glucoses that have been hooked together. That's why it's a polysaccharide. Glucose is a monosaccharide. Polysaccharides are way too big to enter the body. That's why we have to digest them in the alimentary canal while they're still outside the body, break them into smaller and smaller sugars until they're finally monosaccharides. So glucose is not the only monosaccharide, but it's the main one. There are also galactose and fructose and all kinds of other monosaccharides as well, but these are the three main ones we get from food. anyway, the large sugars that are in food have to get broken down a little bit at a time into smaller and smaller. Now, oligosaccharides, oligo means a few, they're made of not just one subunit, but several subunits, just not many. They're not polysaccharides, they're smaller. So polysaccharides get broken down into oligosaccharides, which then get broken down into disaccharides, which are just two monosaccharides big. Things like lactose, maltose, and sucrose. Sucrose is table sugar. And those still need to be broken down into individual monosaccharides. And that happens at different places. Starch starts to get digested in the mouth because of salivary amylase. Amyl means starch, by the way. And enzymes' names end in ASE. That's how you can tell they're enzymes. So amylase is a starch enzyme, breaks down starch. It only works in the mouth because even though it's still in there, still in the food bolus, when that food bolus gets to the stomach, when it gets to the stomach, the pH drops drastically because of the hydrochloric acid, and that destroys the salivary amylase. So it takes a pause in the stomach, and then when it gets to the when the carbohydrates get to the small intestine, pancreatic amylase, which is one component of pancreatic juice, gets delivered to that chyme, and that continues the process of breaking down the carbohydrates into smaller and smaller. By the time you're in the small intestine, that chyme is also getting exposed to this so-called brush border. The brush border is the collection of all these little microvilli I was talking about. So they not only increase the surface area for absorption purposes, but that surface, which is plasma membrane surface, houses intestinal enzymes, small intestinal enzymes, like dextrinase, lactase, sucrase, and so on that you see here. Those are names for individual enzymes that break these already pretty small sugars into even smaller ones, monosaccharides. So sucrose gets broken down into glucose and fructose, for instance, and so on. Then they are finally small enough, these monosaccharides, to be absorbed. That's when they actually pass from the line, from the lumen of the gut through the epithelial cells and then into blood capillaries that are in the villi. So these monosaccharides enter the bloodstream directly, and then they are going to go next through vessels to the liver. But they travel through another version of a portal system. We talked about portal systems before. There's a hepatic portal system that delivers things to the liver. In 18, we're looking at a similar slide, but now we're concerned with the digestion and absorption of proteins. Proteins are huge molecules. They are not made up of monosaccharides. Instead, they're made up of different subunits called amino acids. So proteins don't get absorbed into the body. When you eat protein, it remains outside of your body. It gets broken down while it's in the alimentary canal into larger polypeptides. Polypeptides are what proteins are. It gets broken down into smaller ones, but they're still large polypeptides, which then get broken down into smaller polypeptides, eventually into oligopeptides, which are, and even dipeptides, which are just two amino acids big. And then finally, dipeptides and tripeptides get broken down into individual amino acids, and that's when they're finally small enough to enter the body by being absorbed through this epithelium. And just like the monosaccharides from carbohydrates enter the bloodstream at the villi, so do the amino acids that come from proteins. But how does this breakdown occur? Well, as I said, the stomach starts the process because pepsin, which is what pepsinogen gets converted into with the help of hydrochloric acid, that starts the breakdown, but proteins don't get broken down all that much in the stomach. When those proteins then get delivered to the small intestine, There are proteases, which is just a general word meaning enzymes that break down proteins, that are components of the pancreatic juice. And trypsin, chymotrypsin, and carboxypeptidase, those are just specific examples of proteases. They chemically digest proteins into even smaller ones. And then finally, to finish off the job, enzymes that are in the brush border of the small intestine break small peptides into individual amino acids, which can then be absorbed. Similar slide in 19, but now we're looking at fats being digested. Now, a fat is not as big as the polymers we just talked about. Polysaccharides are polymers of monosaccharides. Proteins are polymers of amino acids. Fats are not actually polymers, but they still do have components that they're made out of. And there's really four components to an individual fat. A fat is also called a triglyceride because it's four part. It's a glycerol, which is one of the four parts, and then three fatty acids. And that's why it's called a triglyceride, because there's three fatty acids connected to a glycerol. That's the overall fat, a triglyceride. That's too big to enter the body as well. So it has to be digested into its component parts. So it can be broken down completely, meaning all you have is a glycerol by itself and three fatty acids by themselves. Or you can take off two of the fatty acids, which are fatty acids by themselves, and leave just one fatty acid connected to a glycerol, and that's called a monoglyceride. Either way, a monoglyceride or individual glycerol and individual fatty acids, those are all small enough to then be absorbed. They get absorbed at the villus of the small intestine, but they don't go, as I was saying earlier, directly into the blood capillaries. They instead go into the lacteals, which are those lymphatic capillaries in the villus. Now, they'll eventually, the fatty acids in, that are going into there will eventually make their way into the bloodstream because lymph dumps into the blood. I should have said, by the way, that the glycerol does not go into the lacteals. The glycerol, once it's by itself, is really just a carbohydrate that comes from fat. So it will go into the blood capillaries, but the fatty acids go into the lacteals. Now, how do they get broken down? Well, they first get emulsified. Emulsification is not digestion because you're not breaking fats down into glycerol and fatty acids when you're emulsifying. What you're doing is emulsifying a big fat droplet which contains many, many thousands of fat molecules as a big droplet, breaking that into smaller and smaller droplets. That's what the bile does from the liver. But by making it into smaller and smaller droplets, that gives it each droplet a chance to be exposed to lipases, which are enzymes in pancreatic juice that are responsible for breaking those fat molecules into fatty acids and glycerol. So that happens at the small intestine, but because of pancreatic lipase. Okay, slide 20. This is an overall view of what happens that we've been talking about throughout this chapter. And so finally we have the major functions of the digestive system that I mentioned at the beginning slide. Even though I didn't give you the names of these five major processes, well, six actual major processes, they're shown here. Ingestion really refers to eating. You're taking food into the oral cavity. Not into the body yet, like I said, but you're putting it into the alimentary canal. Mechanical breakdown is what I was calling mechanical digestion. So that includes mastication, which occurs in the oral cavity, but it also occurs in the churning of the stomach. And to a lesser extent, there is some mechanical breakdown in the small intestine as well. And we'll take a closer look at that in a minute. But mechanical digestion is a second major function of the digestive system. It's a second part of food processing. Propulsion refers to moving this stuff, whether it's food first or chyme or feces. It needs to get moved along the way in one direction. That's what propulsion is. And that occurs because of the action of muscles. That's why every part of the alimentary canal has to have that muscularis externa layer that we were talking about. And that propulsion refers to, includes swallowing, which is deglutition I was talking about. That involves muscular movements, not only the tongue, but muscles of the pharynx. And also peristalsis. Peristalsis refers to muscular movements that squeeze, narrow the diameter of the lumen, and therefore squeeze the contents to the next part of the alimentary canal in line. And this is why, for instance, you could, if you really wanted to, stand on your head and take a drink, and that, even though that's moving against gravity, because this would be upward if you were standing on your head, peristalsis still forces things in the correct direction because it's muscular contraction forcing that contents through. But peristalsis not only moves things through the esophagus to the stomach, peristalsis also continues throughout the small intestine and large intestine, moving the chyme through the small intestine and moving the feces through the large intestine. Absorption is, in a sense, the most important of the functions of the digestive system, because without absorption, the digestive system wouldn't really be helping us at all. The whole reason we need the digestive system is because we need to get that material into our bodies. That's what absorption is. And notice that absorption, as we were talking about, occurs not only into the bloodstream directly at the villous blood vessels, but also into the lymphatic system temporarily in the lacteals, which are lymph vessels also in those villi. I went out of order, by the way. I'm sorry about that. Digestion occurs before absorption. Digestion here, I talked about two types of digestion, but the digestion that's on this slide really refers to chemical digestion. Mechanical breakdown is mechanical digestion. Chemical digestion occurs by the action of enzymes, and that occurs all along the length, really, at least for some foodstuffs, starting at the mouth, continuing in the stomach, but most of it by far occurs in the small intestine. Absorption of nutrients occurs at the small intestine, and then absorption of water occurs at the large intestine. And that not only reclaims useful water for the body, preventing it from being lost and preventing from dehydrating the body, but it also makes the feces able to be formed into a pellet, which is delivered during defecation, which is the final function. Notice the FEC here, feces, and the FEC in defecation, and D means to get rid of, like if you debone a chicken, you're taking the bone out. Well, defecation is getting rid of feces, defecation. Okay. At the beginning of the chapter, we're on slide 21 now, and at the beginning of the chapter I was talking about a food bolus being formed right before swallowing. You see that happening here. The reason that the food bolus stays together is because as you masticate, you are exposing those smaller and smaller pieces of food with saliva, which has mucus in it. And that mucus sticks the pieces together into a nice portable device called a food bolus. And after you're done chewing it enough, then that food bolus gets delivered to the back of the oral cavity, which triggers the swallowing reflex. And that involves some intricate muscular movement. Now notice here we have the epiglottis. That's the lid I was saying that has to cover the airway so that this food bolus does not go into your trachea. That would cause you to choke to death, to asphyxiate. You need to keep that open for the airway. This, by the way, you always need to get air to the lungs. And that's why the trachea has cartilaginous rings in it, kind of like It makes it look like dryer hose that keeps it always open. The esophagus, on the other hand, is a tube that you only really need to be using when you're swallowing. Only when you're eating. So it's a collapsible hose, unlike the trachea. It's kind of like the hose that people use to drain their pools. When there's no water flowing through it, it's just flat and not taking up very much room. That's what the esophagus is like before swallowing. And so there is yet another sphincter up here, the upper esophageal sphincter, that is normally closed. When you're not swallowing, it's closed. But when the food bolus gets delivered to the back, that's going to change things. Right now the sphincter is contracted. That's sealing off this upper opening to the esophagus. In 22, the next step, we see that the sphincter now relaxes. This is the upper esophageal sphincter relaxing. That allows this food bolus to then pass through that sphincter and enter the esophagus itself. It's only then that the esophagus opens up, really. Just like the water opens up the hose in it when you're emptying a pool, the food is what really forces open the diameter of the esophagus. But only after the muscle, the sphincter, relaxes to allow it to go through that sphincter. Then as soon as the bolus passes, this upper esophageal sphincter contracts, like we see in slide 23. That seals it back off, and that's important because now when the muscles squeeze, the bolus won't just go back through in the wrong direction. Peristalsis is a wave of contraction of muscles all along the length, but these ones contract first, and that squeezes the bolus a little bit downward, and then these ones contract, and it squeezes a little bit farther downward, and so on, until finally it reaches the other end of the esophagus, as we see in 24. And when that food bolus reaches this other end, it encounters another sphincter, which is normally closed. It's been closed up until this point, but in order for that bolus to reach the stomach, this other sphincter needs to relax. Now, this book is calling it the cardioesophageal sphincter, which is one name, but it can also just be called the cardiac sphincter, so named because of its proximity to the heart, which would be around right here. But remember, that's why this is called the cardiac region of the stomach. The cardiac sphincter relaxes to allow a food bolus to pass through from the esophagus into the stomach itself. And when that food bolus passes, then the cardiac sphincter or cardioesophageal sphincter will contract again until another food bolus comes after you swallow again. Okay, now to 25. When those food boli, the plural of bolus, when you're done eating, in other words, everything's been delivered to the stomach, now the entry and the exit, the cardiac sphincter is the entry and the pyloric sphincter is the exit of the stomach, those are both contracted, they're both sealed off. And now the muscles of the stomach start contracting, moving this chyme, it's now officially called chyme, back and forth within the stomach. But with both sphincters closed, nothing's passing through the stomach. It's just getting swished back and forth. This helps in mechanical digestion, and it also helps in chemical digestion because it's mixing the chyme more and more with the secretions being released by the stomach lining, which includes that hydrochloric acid and the pepsin that pepsinogen gets turned into. So this makes the chyme, after, you know, many minutes, an hour, or however many minutes later, it becomes more and more watery as more and more digestion takes place. And when it gets sufficiently watery, then the pyloric sphincter will relax and allow just a little bit of this stomach chyme, or gastric chyme, gastric means of the stomach, to go through that pyloric sphincter and enter the duodenum. Not all of it, though, just a little bit at a time. And then it will close again, and the stomach will continue to undergo muscular movements that really serve as a grinding purpose, a mechanical digestion. Retropulsion is just refers to movement back and forth. It's not propulsion. Retro means backward. It's propulsion because it's moving food back toward the blind end or the fundus. So while the pyloric sphincter is closed and the cardiac sphincter is closed, things get moved back and forth over and over. But eventually, a little bit at a time, all of the chyme gets delivered in little packets to the small intestine. And that's where most of the digestion will then occur. Now this chyme, because of the hydrochloric acid produced by the cells in the stomach, that very high acidity is going to have to be dealt with, because the enzymes that are in the duodenum, the first part of the small intestine, will be destroyed by low pH or high acidity, and therefore bicarbonate ion from the pancreas, part of pancreatic juice, it gets delivered to this duodenum as chyme gets delivered from the stomach, and that will neutralize that chyme, bring it back to the pH that it works, that these enzymes at the small intestine work very well at. 26 is kind of an overall view, but the focus here is what's happening signal-wise or at an endocrine level. And I don't want to get too bogged down into these chemicals, but it's interesting how this happens. So the chyme enters the duodenum. That's the chyme, remember, is the contents of the stomach. It enters the duodenum. And when that chyme enters there, that's a signal to the enteroendocrine cells that are in the lining here to release a signal called cholecystokinin. Now, let me explain the name of that. Cyst means bag. Col is another word for bile. And the gallbladder is one name for this thing that holds bile that comes from the liver. But another name for the gallbladder, which is really a bile bag, is the cholecyst, or bile bag. Now, the chemical, the signal that's released by these enteroendocrine cells down here in the small intestine, that's called cholecystokinin because it has the effect of causing the muscles of the that line the gallbladder or cholecyst to contract, which moves or squeezes the bile bag. Kinin is a word with the same root as kinetic energy. It's also the same root as cinema. They all mean move. And so cholecystokinin is a signal that moves the gallbladder or bile bag or cholecyst. Okay, so that's CCK. Secretin is another major hormone involved, though. They get both released separately, but at the same time when chyme gets delivered into the small intestine. Now, what do those signals do? Well, the red dots are the cholecystokinin, the blue dots are the secretin. They have different targets. But as you would expect for hormones, they get delivered into the bloodstream. So they get broadcast throughout the body, but eventually they make their way to the liver. The cholecystokinin affects the liver cells, for one thing, and it causes, as you see over here, the cholecystokinin causes the liver to release more bile, but it also, as I said, the reason it's named cholecystokinin has the cholecyst or gallbladder as a target tissue, and it causes it to squeeze. So the bile that's already been stored in that gallbladder gets squeezed out of it through the bile duct into the lumen, which is where this chyme is being received. So that's an appropriate response. Now, at the same time, the cholecystokinin traveling through the bloodstream makes it to the pancreas. And the pancreas responds to cholecystokinin by increasing its rate of secretion of pancreatic juice with enzymes in it. Remember I said there's two components to pancreatic juice. There's part of it has digestive enzymes. That's the part that gets released in response to cholecystokinin. Okay, now secretin, which is the blue dots, also gets delivered in the, via the bloodstream, and it will stimulate the liver as well. So they work kind of similarly, but they are separate chemicals, cholecystokinin and secretin, by the way. But secretin also causes, unlike cholecystokinin, secretin also increases the motility of the stomach. So when the small intestine is receiving chyme, it's releasing secretin, which will go back to the stomach and say, increase your motility so that the small intestine can receive its next batch after I'm done with this one. Okay, now secretin affects the pancreas as well, but this, unlike cholecystokinin, which releases enzymes from the pancreas, the secretin releases bicarbonate ions from the pancreas. That's what I said is neutralizing it. And so that neutralization is important because that brings the pH back up to a level where the enzymes from the pancreas can do their job in the small intestine along with the enzymes that are part of the brush border. Step five, vagal stimulation. Vagal is the adjective of vagus, V-A-G-U-S. I didn't have you memorize the names of the 12 cranial nerves, but the vagus is number 10 of those 12. Vagus means wanderer, and the reason it got its name is because all 11 of the other cranial nerves stay in the head and neck, but the vagal nerve is the wanderer because that nerve goes down into the thorax and abdomen. And one of the targets, as you see here, this is the vagus nerve, is these organs of the digestive system. So there's also nervous input, not just hormonal input, but nervous input. Okay, now 27. We see two different kinds of muscular movement here in the small intestine. In part A, we have peristalsis. And peristalsis is all about moving in one direction. So a wave of contraction, first in this region, then in the next region, and then next region along the length, that's going to move things in the proper direction from mouth to anus, or from the mouth end to the anus end of the tube. So that includes the chyme that's in the small intestine. But in the small intestine, you also have a different kinds of muscular movement called segmentation, which instead of moving it in just one direction, will have simultaneous contractions spaced apart, as you see here. So notice they're squeezing it here, 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 and here at the same time. And then those parts will relax, and they'll squeeze here, here, and here. Well, this has the effect of breaking this chyme into pieces, and then breaking each piece into two pieces and mixing it with pieces from the other one, moving it back and forth, in other words. This is called segmentation because it has the effect of breaking the chyme into little segments eventually. And then after that's been done for a while, peristalsis will move these segments individually along their way. 28. Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier about the major nutrient classes. Here we're looking at some amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Proteins are one of the major nutrient classes, but proteins are polymers. Proteins are made of subunits called amino acids. And no matter what organism you're talking about, there are 20 amino acids that make up the proteins in all living things. But when we eat proteins, it's made up of 20 amino acids once you break those proteins into those individual amino acids. But some of those 20 amino acids we can make in the body. There are 9 of those 20, though, that we can't make, and therefore we have to get those from our food. Now, this shows only 8. For some reason, they didn't include histidine. But if I don't want you to memorize these names, but if you add histidine to this list, these would be the nine so-called essential amino acids. We can't make these amino acids out of other things, so they have to come from our food. The other 11 amino acids we can make from other things, including other amino acids. They can be converted into the other ones. But another important point, though, is that we don't, as I said before, we don't take in proteins. We don't take them into our body. We take them in as our food, but we digest them while they're in the alimentary canal because they're too big to be taken in or absorbed. We break them into their individual amino acids. Then once those amino acids are in the body, we build our own proteins out of the instructions that are in our genes by rearranging these amino acids. 29. Carbohydrates include large sugars and small sugars. The large ones are polysaccharides. Disaccharides consist of just two monosaccharides hooked together, whereas polysaccharides are many. And then monosaccharides themselves are simple sugars. Those are the individual building blocks. And monosaccharides make up they're used for different things, but as far as food is concerned, or as far as energy is concerned, monosaccharides are the major fuel for all cells. Glucose specifically is the major fuel monosaccharide. And so polysaccharides are too big to get into the body. They get digested into smaller and smaller sugars until you finally have monosaccharides. We talked about this earlier. They get put into the body through the small intestinal lining into the bloodstream, and they get used as fuel, which allows for the production of ATP molecules. ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate, but we've talked about it a little bit before in earlier chapters. It is a way of temporarily storing energy that used to be in food and that can be used to do things that the cell requires but that needs energy to be done. Glycogen, by the way, is another polysaccharide, but glycogen is a polysaccharide that we make in our body. This is a major function of the liver and also skeletal muscles. They can take in glucose that's been taken in from the food that we eat after it's been digested into glucose. The liver and the muscles can then take that glucose from the blood, hook them together to make glycogen, which is the animal version of a storage polysaccharide. Plants make starches, animals make glycogen. Slide 30, similar slide, but now we're talking about fats, which, remember, can also be called triglycerides. Well, here you see a cartoon of why these are called triglycerides. You have three fatty acids, which are individually hooked to the same glycerol molecule. And so all four of those things, the glycerol and the three fatty acids, make up one fat or one triglyceride. Too big to be taken in, so they first get emulsified by the bile coming from the liver, making it easier to be digested using the enzymatic function of lipases from the pancreas. And that breaks them into individual fatty acids and individual glycerol molecules. The glycerol enters the bloodstream, the fatty acids enter the lacteals, but eventually get dumped into the bloodstream. Now, fats are also major energy sources. They store energy much more efficiently, so per gram there's a lot more energy in a fat than there is in carbohydrates. And that's why when we take in extra calories, whether it's we take it in as fat in the food or anything else, we build fat molecules. You know, for instance, we take in extra calories as candy. That's pure sugar, pure carbohydrate. We will turn that into fat because we can store it much more efficiently that way. So fat is stored energy, and it gets used for energy when glucose levels start to drop. Proteins are illustrated in 31. Proteins are also huge molecules. They're also polymers, just like polysaccharides, except they're made of monomers called amino acids. And that's what they need to be digested to while they're into, while they're still outside of the body, before they can be absorbed. And we talked about that already. And here we have individual amino acids. Those, unlike fatty acids and monosaccharides, amino acids are typically not used too much as fuel. They can be, but they're usually not, which is why we don't need all that much protein in our diet. And a lot of people are getting massive overdoses of proteins, really. There's association between that and cancer. We don't need so much because we reuse our proteins. Since we're not burning them as fuel, we can break a protein down into amino acids and then build a new protein out of the amino acids using our genes as instructions. We do lose them a little bit, though. That's why we have to have some protein in our diet. About 9% is an appropriate level. They can be used as fuel, but normally infrequent. We usually recycle them and use them for all kinds of other things. Proteins do just about every important function in any cell. 32. Here we have all three of these major subunits that came from the three major nutrient classes: monosaccharides, fatty acids, and amino acids. If they're used as fuels, which amino acids, like I just said, are usually not, they can be. If they're used as fuel, though, any of these subunits will be processed in a central biochemical pathway called cellular respiration, which I'm not going to get into the particulars of, but this is what occurs in the mitochondria of cells in the body. And what that accomplishes is extracts energy, chemical energy, from these subunits that came from food and puts that energy into the bonds of ATP molecules. So this is how we get energy from the food we eat. And if we do that, these subunits get broken down even further, even more than digestion has already broken them down into. This occurs within the cells of the body, and the result of that is carbon dioxide and water. The carbon dioxide that you breathe out is what's left over from the food that you ate originally. I think 33 is the final slide, and this, we've had slides very similar to this before. This is one of these homeostatic slides that shows you how things work homeostatically in the body, but this one's related to the digestive system and specifically to glucose balance. So there is at any given moment, there is a blood sugar level. Blood sugar is glucose. It's not the only monosaccharide, but it's the main monosaccharide. And there's always some of it present in the blood, which keeps us alive because, unlike the rest of the body, the brain needs a continuous supply of glucose. It can use only glucose under normal circumstances, or if you're starving, it can use something that's called ketone bodies. But the normal only fuel for the brain is glucose. It can't use other fuels. That's why there has to be a continuous supply delivered to the brain. And that's why there has to be always a proper glucose level in the blood. Now, if the blood glucose level drops, well, let's start up here on getting too high. If you have rising blood glucose level, well, first of all, why would you have that? You have that after absorption. So not while you're eating, but after you've eaten, and after digestion of that meal has occurred, and then finally absorption of those subunits into the body, that's when the glucose, which came from the food, is finally in the blood. And so that causes a big increase in blood glucose level. Well, that is an error in one direction, right? Remember, homeostasis involves an error. So the error here is that the blood glucose level is too high. This gets sensed by the pancreas, So the endocrine system is involved here. Remember, the pancreas is not only a member of the digestive system, it's also a member of the endocrine system. And so cells of the pancreas respond to a high blood glucose level by secreting insulin, and insulin travels through the bloodstream to the liver, and it causes liver to undergo a process which is called glycogenesis. Now, glycogenesis is production of or creation of glycogen. Okay, now what is glycogen? I just told you a little bit earlier. Glycogen is a storage polysaccharide made out of a bunch of glucoses hooked together. So, in response to insulin, the liver takes the glucoses, which there's too many of in the blood, out of the blood, hooks them together, and forms a big molecule called glycogen to store that for later. This brings the blood glucose level back down to normal. And meanwhile, your brain is kept alive because it's getting glucose. Now it's been hours since you've eaten, and the brain and the rest of the body has been using that blood glucose, so now it's falling to a lower than normal level. On the right side of the figure, you see this. So this is an error in the other direction. Well, once again, the pancreas responds, but it responds differently. When the blood glucose level drops, then the pancreas releases a different chemical, one you've studied already, which is glucagon. And glucagon has an opposite effect compared to insulin on the liver. When glucagon reaches the liver, it tells the liver to undergo what is called glycogenolysis. Glycogenesis is creation of glycogen. Glycogenolysis is lysis or splitting of glycogen. And so that's this glycogen that the liver made earlier by hooking together a bunch of glucoses, it now splits those glycogen molecules back into individual glucoses. That's what glycogenolysis is. And those glucose molecules that come from the glycogen then get put back into the blood, and this brings the level back up to normal. This keeps your brain alive, and therefore it keeps you alive. That is the chapter.